This episode contains discussion of graphic violence, murder, and drug use. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. On May 12, 2007, Garnett Lennox's Pontiac Bonneville was discovered on a 13,000 block of Loretto Street in what the Fraser-Clinton Township Chronicle described as, quote, Detroit's East Side. Garnett, who was 40, had been missing from his Clinton Township home for days. Per the Chronicle, his mother had filed a report with the Township Police Department on May 9th. The Detroit News gave the date of the missing person's filing as May 8th. Clinton Township is a suburb of Detroit. It lies north of the city. Nearly 200 years ago, there were grand plans to make it the site of a canal that would carry travelers up and down state. But, per the Historical Society, money ran out and Clinton Township became a sawmill town. Nowadays, it's home to 100,000 or so people, citizens who rate their schools as above average. And it's run by leaders who describe the area as friendly to development. It's only 10 miles or so to Detroit. You cross a county line from Macomb to Wayne. Whether Garnett Lennox took himself over that line and drove into the city in early May of 2007, we can't say. There are signs that point to him doing so, and signs that point to a very different conclusion. His family has heard rumors over the years, but he certainly didn't leave his car in East Detroit, on Loretto Street, not on his own volition at least. His family had been looking for him in Clinton Township and making calls. His sons, who were living down in North Carolina with his ex-wife, they were waiting for news. Clinton Township PD had been alerted, and according to a FOIA we received from that department, Garnett's mother stated that she initially had trouble filing a missing persons report for her son, but that she managed it after speaking with several local offices, both in Clinton Township and in Detroit. Everyone, from his brothers to his roommate, noted that it was unusual for Garnett to be out all night without calling, much less to be gone for days. But no one was able to locate him. Ultimately, it was a report about Garnett's Pontiac that brought law enforcement out in the early afternoon of May 12th. However, they weren't following up on a report of a missing man. According to the Fraser-Clinton Township Chronicle, someone was concerned about the car. There was an odor, a caller reported, that was worrying. After investigating the scene, Detroit police told the Detroit News that they discovered a body in the trunk of the Pontiac. It was Garnett Lennox. The Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office would later release the information that Garnett had been shot twice, and that they believed he'd been dead for at least 3 days. Based on what we could find, there was scant coverage of Garnett's murder in local media. There were a few articles in Clinton Township area papers and in the Detroit News. We also found a letter to the editor written by Garnett's mother, Vernice. One of Garnett's sons, Andrew, remembers that his grandmother appeared on the local evening news as well to talk about Garnett's murder. And, 2 months after Garnett was discovered, the Detroit Police Department appeared on another local broadcast seeking tips. Garnett's brothers also appeared on that news spot. You can still watch that one on YouTube. Garnett's brothers are dressed in suits, and they're standing near the spot where Garnett's car was discovered. They say that they don't want another family to have to experience this kind of grief. They want Garnett's killer caught. You see, their family had already been through this once. Facing it again, only 16 years later, was excruciating. Garnett's cousin, Bernice Gray, she disappeared on December 26, 1991. Per the Detroit News, Bernice had begun her day as usual. She'd left early in the morning to drop off her daughter at a babysitter's and then headed into work. But Bernice had never arrived. Maybe, as her stepfather Sandy Ulmer told the Detroit News, that wouldn't have raised immediate flags for another 23-year-old, but Bernice's employer had called their home soon after she failed to show, worried about her. Sandy told reporters, quote, "She works full-time, goes to school, and cares for her daughter. Bernice is very dependable." As soon as the family received the call, Sandy and Bernice's mother Jean and other members of the family gathered together, and they began to search. Sandy said, quote, "We searched all the streets, around the babysitters, and also the parking lots in Southfield, and we found nothing." The paper mentioned that Bernice's father and her boyfriend were also aiding in search efforts, but there was no sign of Bernice's car, which the Detroit News described as a 1987 Pontiac. There wouldn't be a sign of it. Not for 5 days. The Detroit News reported that Bernice's car was found, quote, "on Eastland in Detroit. Her keys were still in the ignition. And there was, quote, a large amount of blood on the front seat. And, per law enforcement, there were also bullet shell casings." Bernice's family was faced with a missing persons case that had taken the most tragic possible turn. And, as Detroit News noted in early January of 1992, there seemed to already be some sense of where the investigation might be headed. Reporters noted that Bernice's friends were coming forward with stories about her relationship with her boyfriend, saying that he'd proposed and that Bernice had not accepted. There was even the possibility that they'd actually broken up a few weeks prior to her disappearance. Though investigators searched for Bernice, her body was never recovered. The Gray and Ulmer families were faced with another crisis while the search for her was still ongoing. Their temporary custody of her daughter was in question. Bernice's boyfriend, Robert Pan, wanted their child, but by that point, he was a named suspect in the case, though he had not been formally charged. Bernice and her cousin Garnett, they came from a large, extended family with deep roots in Michigan and in Canada. Some of Bernice and Garnett's family were or are enrolled members of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, which, according to the tribe's official website, quote, is a federally recognized Native American tribe in what is now known as Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Some family did not maintain formal ties, but were culturally aware of their relationship to the tribe and their extended relations. This information became vital in the custody dispute that arose concerning Bernice's child. According to both legal records and UPI reports, Bernice's mother, Jean, sought to have the custody hearing for her grandchild moved to the tribal court. Per the UPI, in October of 1992, almost a year after her death, Bernice and her daughter were enrolled in the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. Then, in December of the same year, then-tribal registrar Linda Smith testified at an initial hearing as to Bernice's great-grandfather's enrollment in the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians and the successive enrollment of Bernice and her daughter. Bernice's parents were successful. The court ruled that, indeed, Bernice's daughter's case fell under the Indian Child Welfare Act, and the case was moved to tribal court. Bernice's parents were granted custody of her daughter, but it would be years before Bernice's case went to court. Further forensic examination of her car found that, quote, brain matter was evident, and that, per Detroit News, police believed that she had died of a bullet wound to the head. But investigators still weren't able to proceed with an arrest. Meanwhile, Robert Pan was arrested for unrelated violent crimes in the interim. The Detroit Free Press reported that he was, quote, held on $350,000 bond on charges that he tried to beat a St. Clair Shores man to death in June of 1992, about 6 months after Bernice was last seen. The Detroit News wrote in November of 1994 that he was charged with the assault of his current girlfriend outside a club they'd both been at. In 1997, Robert was sentenced to 6 years in prison for beating his wife, a different woman than the girlfriend he'd assaulted in 1994. Per the Detroit Free Press, he'd attacked his wife in April of 1996 and left her badly beaten in her car. It's plain that, based on media reports, people were reminded of Bernice's death. Robert was described during his trial for domestic abuse as the prime suspect in Bernice's murder. And 3 years later, it seemed that law enforcement finally felt they had enough to move forward. The Detroit Free Press reported in 2000 that Robert Pann was formally charged in the murder of Bernice Gray. Prosecutors decided to move forward, quote, after realizing that they wouldn't find the body and that further delay would hurt the case. And they were successful. Robert Pann was convicted in January 2001. It had been just over 9 years since Bernice dropped her daughter off and never returned. And now, in 2007, her family, the Lennox branch, and by extension, all of them, were facing it all again with Garnett Lennox. We were connected to Garnett's family through our friend, Nina Instead of Already Gone. She worked with Bernice's family back in 2018 to tell Bernice's story. When Andrew, Garnett's son, first got in contact with us, he told us that there has not been a suspect named in the media or a press push to keep his father's case going. But Garnett's family believes that this is a very solvable case. Andrew believes that with attention, with the right tip to back up some of what they've heard, law enforcement can close Garnett's murder. He and his brother have lived a very long time without their father, half their lives now. And Garnett's favorite role in his life was being their dad. There is so much that he's missed. This fall, Brooke sat down with Andrew, one of Garnett's two sons, to talk about his dad and the case. They began with Garnett's childhood and what it was like growing up in and around Detroit.
My dad, he lived his whole life in, you know, around Detroit, Michigan. He grew up playing hockey, running around the neighborhood. You know, he was a really goofy guy. You know, he always liked to put a smile on everyone's faces. He actually, for Halloween, he went as a clown until he was about 21 years old, just so he could make everybody laugh without people actually knowing it was him. But my dad was one of those guys, you hear a joke and you know it's him. Actually, there's a lot of favorite jokes that I still tell people to this day that were his jokes. You know, my dad was always the goofiest guy. He was always happy. You know, he could walk into a room and make everybody smile just from the smile he had on his face.
He had a big personality.
He did. And that's kind of why I do, too, because I'm the spinning image of him. Pretty much all the Lennox boys from the past four generations could possibly pass off as brothers if you find the right pictures. It's kind of scary.
Okay, so tell me, your dad had two younger brothers. What do you know about their childhood growing up? Were they close in age?
Yeah, they were pretty close in age. Mike is, I believe, 2 years younger. And then Jerry, I think, would be 5 years younger, if I got that right. And to be honest with you, my dad was kind of a bully. You know, he was the older brother. Yeah, you know, he had to bully the little ones a little bit. I mean, that's just every boy growing up. If you got an older brother, he's going to bully you.
How do your uncles talk about their big brother?
They miss him a whole heck of a lot, I can tell you that. My dad was a very big family person. He was always the one to drop almost everything to go help out his brothers. The only thing that he would never drop to go help them out was me and my brother. Because, you know, we were his life, you know, me and my brother. But that doesn't mean that he wouldn't bring us along to go help them out. You know, my Uncle Mike, you know, he has a son too, Kyle. We were close with all the family. I mean, that's just the way they were. That's the way we grew up. You know, we were always doing the big Christmas parties, the big Easter parties, you know, 4th of July. To this day, I'm meeting family I've never met before in my life. Like, okay, so you're technically like my fourth cousin? No, I'm your second cousin. Who are you again? Like, stuff like that, you know? most of my family lives in Warren, Michigan, and St. Clair Shores, Michigan, and Sterling Heights, Michigan, which is all like right there within, I want to say, 30 miles of each other. So, you know, there'd be a 3-bedroom suburban house on a 16th of an acre with like 200 people in it. Everybody just came along and we just, big family. You know, if you had a friend that didn't have anything going on, bring them to, you know, it didn't matter. There's going to be enough food. That's just the way our family was. My dad was a pretty athletic person. He always liked to play like hockey and football. I'm not really sure about his academics. He graduated high school, but I'm not sure if he was, you know, like top of his class or anything like that. Probably not. My dad was a jack of all trades, master of none, you know, kind of like how I am. So, you know, he passed and everything like that, but he was always athletic. He was always trying to do something like in sports. He didn't like playing football, which bugged the crap out of me because we grew up such big football fans. And I'm like, Dad, you didn't like it? And he's like, no, I played 2 days. I'm like, well, I'm gonna give it a shot. And he was like, go ahead. Like, I don't know if he was like popular, but everybody knew who he was, you know? I mean, I know he had a decent amount of friends, but it's like when my dad was a senior, even freshmen knew who he was because, you know, he screwed with everybody. You know, he was just always trying to get a laugh, telling jokes. He was the class clown.
Andrew and Garnett were always particularly close, maybe because they had a lot in common, but it might have come down to the fact that Garnett liked to spend time with his sons. Garnett and his wife, Andrew and his brother's mother, divorced when the boys were young. Before they moved to North Carolina with Andrew's mother and stepfather, Garnett was a steady presence in their lives. But even after, Garnett seemed to concentrate all his energy and focus on the times his sons would come to visit.
My dad was always the one who was there. My dad was my whole support system growing up. Because it didn't matter what I was doing. If my dad had no interest in it, he tried to get an interest in it just because, you know, of me and my brother. Like when video games first came about, my dad didn't know what video games really were. He, you know, he had Atari and stuff like that. So when we first got like a PlayStation and stuff like that, we were like, oh, this game is so cool. And my dad would sit there and watch it, not having a clue what's going on, but he'd still sit there and take part and watch it. He was always there. Like my dad worked factory jobs, you know, even worked 12-hour shifts at one point. But still, if we needed to be picked up for school for some reason, my dad was always there. You know, I grew up, you know, with bipolar, so I did get in a lot of fights. And my dad was always the one to pick me up from school and get me lunch and stuff like that. And then, you know, wanted me to explain what happened to him, and I would say it. And he'd be like, all right, well, I respect your reason, but you're still grounded for 2 weeks. They were just completely different about raising us. It was like almost a night and day difference. You know, like that's why I like to crack jokes a lot, because my dad liked to crack jokes a lot. Me and my dad, like wherever my dad was, I was there too. Like even after they got divorced, I would always have my friends want to come hang out at my house so we can involve my dad in hanging out with us. You know, my brother would like to, you know, run off and hang out with his friends, you know, whatever. But, you know, my dad would, like, my friends would want to hang out with my dad, too, because my dad was always so involved. He was funny. And my dad loved it. It was pretty awesome. I mean, I only got to, like, when they actually got divorced, I was only at my dad's house, like, every other weekend. You know, and then a whole 2 weeks in the summer. You know, my dad, he would always not make plans, you know, that weekend, not unless he could bring us too. We'd go see movies, we'd go to cookouts and stuff like that. Like almost every weekend when it wasn't winter, because, you know, in wintertime it sucked up there. But then, you know, in wintertime we'd get on the hockey pads and go out on the lake for a while. I moved down to North Carolina with my mom and my stepdad when I was 13. So it was back in February 18th, 2006 is when we moved down here. My stepdad, he's a great guy and everything like that, but him and I didn't have a whole lot of the same interests like me and my dad did. Grew up loving football and hockey and stuff like that. So I would try to watch, you know, as much football as I could to talk with my dad about it, because in North Carolina, they don't televise hockey games. But so when I first moved down here, I was in middle school. You know, my dad was still alive. And I had a pretty good year finishing out my eighth grade year here. And I had a pretty good year. Everything was going good for me. And then when I hit high school, I went up to Michigan for about a month to hang out with my dad and see him and everything like that. And, you know, he was dating this girl that I didn't really care for. You know, she was stealing my dad away from me, you know, kind of jealousy a little bit. You know, so my dad, you know, would pretty much, you know, do what he always did, you know, not make any plans for that whole month except go to work. You know, come home, hang out, watch TV, go to the movies, you know, it's the same stuff we always did, except she was there too. And I thought it started taking effect on my dad a little bit more. I didn't realize it at the time, but my dad would always try to do so much in such a little bit amount of time with us, you know, just to hang out, you know, taking days off work because we wanted to go out and do something, you know, and he was just, you know, he was that kind of person, you know. He just wanted to hang out with me and my brother. Now, when I came down here to start high school, I really started missing my dad a whole lot. I got pretty violent, you know, started fighting a lot. One of our past running backs for the football team, I got into an altercation with him. And now, at the time, he stood about 5 inches taller than me, had about 100 pounds on me, clocked me right in the mouth, chipped my tooth, dislocated my jaw. I called my dad and he was like, "Boy, you're dumb trying to fight somebody that big." And I was just like, yeah, I thought I could take him though. And he was like, "Well, did you fight out of anger or common sense?" And I was like, "Anger." And he was like, "That's why you lost." And so, yeah. You know, he was just a good guy.
According to Andrew, Garnett was dealing with issues in the last few years before his death that Andrew was not fully aware of, not at the time at least. Andrew told us that he and his brother were not aware of the signs of possible drug dependence their father had begun to display. According to Andrew's accounts, a letter to the editor we found from Garnett's mother, and Clinton Township Police reports, Garnett's drug use in the last few years of his life is something that has been up for debate. Garnett's mother, who has since passed away, did not believe that he was using heroin in the years preceding his death, and felt that he was painted in that light based on some of his associations, especially a close relationship with an individual with a heroin dependence. Andrew's understanding is that his father did have issues with drugs. We certainly are not the ones to make a judgment either way, but the topic is important to mention because it comes up repeatedly in the rumors surrounding Garnett's death. Andrew feels that Garnett worked very hard to shield the boys from that side of his life. It was not something that was openly discussed in the family, but after his children moved down south, it was hard on him. And that was not the only factor that led to what Andrew believes was his father's drug dependence. Andrew told us that prior to his own move to North Carolina, an individual who needed a place to stay spent time living with Garnett. That individual is said to have had a heroin dependency and to have introduced Garnett to the drug. After that, other, newer associations may have exacerbated a dependence. This is all information that Andrew learned later in life, but he feels that the pieces fit.
I did not realize it, what was going on at the time. Because, you know, I was 12, you know. I didn't know what heroin was back then. I started getting this feeling, but it was hard to tell because you know, my dad always tried to stay clean when me and my brother were coming over.
Were you ever worried about his safety?
No, I really wasn't. Even though I kind of should have been, because my dad was always the one to take care of himself. He was very bright about, you know, about staying away when he needed to, and, you know, when to come and when to go. You know, he was always kind of bright about that. There was some suspicions I had when I was coming up there a few times about what he was doing and stuff like that, because he seemed a little off sometimes. And it wasn't until I was about 20 years old that I found out that, he was on heroin. So, and this dated back to even before he died. I mean, my dad was a superhero. I mean, I never thought anything could happen to him like that. I thought he was going to outlive me. He was always the one to be the one to take care of himself. I mean, he ate right. He took daily vitamins. He worked out all the time. He knew how to do almost everything, and I just never thought it.
The role Garnett's alleged drug use played in his disappearance and murder has not been publicly detailed or speculated on by law enforcement, not at least in the media. But in one of the few articles concerning his disappearance and death, there is a heavy focus on drugs. And that was very upsetting to his mother, who wrote the letter to the editor we mentioned earlier in the episode, to say that she'd been misunderstood when she reported Garnett as a heroin user to police. Rather, she felt that he was helping someone else, someone close to him, get off of drugs, and that was what led him into a dangerous situation. According to Clinton Township police records, Garnett's mother also sent a letter to their office expressing a similar sentiment, and including the further detail that someone else had told her that he was using heroin, and that she'd expressed that to police. Not that she'd had the knowledge herself, or any indication or proof that it was true. She noted that she'd spoken to his close friends, who told her they did not believe that Garnett was, quote, a heavy user of drugs, and that they would have known if he was. She did note that an associate of Garnett's, whom she noted was a heroin user, had told another person that Garnett had stolen something, and that the people to whom it belonged would be very angry. But Garnett's mother had no indication of what that might be, or if it was even true. Andrew told us that, at least from what he later learned, the idea of Garnett using drugs was extremely hard on his grandmother. She wanted him to be portrayed as she saw him, and as he was, a loving son and a brother, and most of all, a father. We know from our work on this show that when drugs are introduced to the media equation, sympathetic coverage of a victim can be harder to get. Media audiences can show a frightening lack of interest in the death of a human being as soon as the specter of drugs appears. According to the Detroit News, shortly after Garnett's body was discovered, the paper reached out to both the Detroit Police Department, who were handling Garnett's homicide investigation at that time, and the Clinton Township Police Department, where his missing persons report had been filed. The former declined to comment, citing the ongoing investigation, but then-chief of the CTPD offered several comments on the case. These were the comments that Garnett's mother responded to in her letter. Chief Richard Meyerly told the Detroit News, quote, according to Lennox's girlfriend, he had been doing drugs earlier in the day, and then he took off. Other than the missing person, there was no indication there were signs of foul play. There isn't much to do in a case like this. He was an adult, and if he wants to take off, that's his business. All we can do if we find him is to tell him his family is looking for him, end quote. He added that when they interviewed Garnett's girlfriend, she advised the police that the couple, quote, often purchased heroin on the east side of Detroit. Clinton Township noted that was the area of Detroit where Garnett's car was discovered. Although the paper noted that there were no signs of foul play, police reports that we received just days before recording seemed to contradict this. In fact, it seems that there were signs of violence discovered in Garnett's home. According to the Clinton Township file, which includes the activities of both DPD and CTPD, a Detroit police detective gained a search warrant for Garnett's apartment after being advised by his roommate that an individual known to Garnett had, quote, ransacked Garnett's bedroom. When DPD entered the residence, they discovered, quote, blood on the floor in the bathroom and blood on the floor in the laundry room. They further found blood spatter on the wall in the deceased victim's bedroom, end quote. We discovered that, at this point, the case was turned back over to the Clinton Township Police Department, so it was not from that point on in the hands of Detroit police, as we'd previously thought. We reached out to the Detroit Police Department, both via FOIA filing and interview request, for a statement on Garnett's case, but we've not received a response, except for a notification of FOIA extension at the time of this broadcast. We also reached out to the Clinton Township Police Department and received our fulfillment just a few days before this episode was set to record, and that brought us quite a bit more information to consider. That includes the fact that, for a time, as we mentioned, the case seems to have ended up back with Clinton Township and not stayed with Detroit for the entire homicide investigation, as we'd previously believed. And while we did not receive an interview from Clinton Township either, we did gather some important information. Law enforcement did not believe, at least for a period of the investigation, that Garnett himself drove his car into Detroit. Brooke asked Andrew if he and his brother had been told about Garnett's disappearance and what information he had leading up to finding out about his father's death.
Yeah. Because we were getting ready for summer vacation, and we were trying to plan out, you know, when to, you know, go up there, where we were meeting, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, because, you know, we were trying to plan it, you know, like a month and a half in advance, you know, to make sure, you know, if something needs to change, you know, we have time to make a change, you know, stuff like that. And my mom kept trying to call him. I kept trying to call him. My stepdad even tried to call him. My mom tried to call him from her work phone. My stepdad tried to call him from his work phone. I tried to call him from school. And he just never picked up. Everybody thought that that was weird.
Had you called your uncles or anything?
No, I called my grandpa and my grandma. Because, you know, they see my dad about once a week. My dad would always go over there about once a week and help them out wherever they needed it, you know, or just hang out and watch a football game, something. So, yeah, I tried to call them, and they didn't hear anything, and I'm saying, my dad's best friend called him up, and he hasn't heard anything. I'm like, oh, this is weird.
It wasn't until a call came in to Andrew's school that he discovered just how serious his father's lack of contact had been.
Well, I was in first period. My dad had been missing for 3 days. And they found his car with his body in the trunk. My mom called. My teacher answered the phone, told her what had happened. And I remember this so well, and I saw the look on her face. She had tears in her eyes already. Handed me the phone. And I didn't want to know because I didn't want to know what happened. And that's when my mom told me that they found my dad. And he's not coming back. I ripped that phone out of the wall. Threw it. Just ran away. I ran out behind the school, just broke down crying right there. I felt like I died there too. Because he was my life. He was my whole support system. He was my best friend. keep thinking, is like, well, how'd they know that that was his body in the trunk? He was so decomposed when they found him, there was no way they could tell. When I was living at my mom and stepdad's house, and you know, here in North Carolina, I always used to go sit out on the front porch. I always expected them to see him drive up.
As soon as possible, Andrew and his brother were flown to Michigan so they could be with the Lennoxes and the rest of their extended family. He was too young to remember what had happened to his cousin Bernice back in 1991. He hadn't even been born when she disappeared. But he'd certainly been alive during the aftermath and the trial of her killer. And now their family was going through it all a second time, with Garnett's murder. Andrew was only 14 years old. He would always need and love his father, but 2007 had been an especially difficult year. Garnett had guided him through much of it. He felt lost.
I went up there for the funeral 2 days later after we made plans and everything to go up there. And, you know, planning stuff, looking through a bunch of my dad's old stuff and finally getting ready to go. Found out that my dad's old hockey team was actually going to wear a bunch of their jerseys to the funeral. I thought, you know what? I got a couple. I'm going to wear a hockey jersey too. So we all did, my brother included, even though he changed by halfway through because it got hot. 283 people showed up for the funeral. It was just that they were just trying to joke around, go run off and cry for about 5 minutes, come back and continue to joke around. After that, personally, something changed in me. I came back to high school, and I didn't really talk to anybody. I didn't really want to. I wasn't the goofball I was before. I wasn't violent either. I didn't talk to anybody. I just did my schoolwork, and that was it. I wasn't the class clown anymore. I wasn't the violent type anymore. To be honest with you, I became a goth. Everybody started being afraid of me and didn't want to talk to me anymore because they knew how violent I was and what I looked like now. Because my high school was in the middle of nowhere. I was the only goth kid in a redneck school full of 180 people total. My brother, he went the complete opposite end I did. Because after my dad passed, I wanted to make him proud. So that's how I jumped my GPA up from a 1.8 to a 3.7. My brother completely went the opposite way because He viewed my stepdad as trying to fill in for my dad, which wasn't the case. You know, about 2 months after the funeral, he came up to me and my brother and he's like, you know, I'm not here to replace your father, right? I was like, I know that. My brother was like, yeah, bullshit. Because he wasn't. I mean, you got to know the man. He really wasn't.
Brooke asked Andrew how Garnett's parents and how his brothers, Andrew's uncles, dealt with the murder.
They handled it the same way I did. My grandpa, he actually used to say all the time, he said, children are not supposed to die before the parents. He used to say that all the time. My grandma kind of shut down and started going to church a lot. She didn't talk about it very much. My grandpa talked about it all the time. My grandpa, he literally said, you know what? If I had the resources, I'd go find that man and kill him myself. I'm old. I don't got nothing left.
What man Andrew's grandfather meant, whether he had a specific man in mind or if he was speaking more generally, we can't prove. But the Clinton Township file included a few more pieces of information that could be important in a review of Garnett's case. Garnett's keys were missing from the vehicle discovery site, and we discovered that at least one individual was questioned in connection with his murder. That questioning included a vehicle search and forensic testing of that vehicle. An arrest was made, but the charges were ultimately dropped. And the reason for the arrest is not specifically detailed in the file. We do know that this person gave conflicting statements regarding both Garnett's murder, their whereabouts, and surrounding other events leading up to the discovery of his body. Investigators reviewed Garnett's phone records and interviewed his associates and found he'd been in contact with people through at least the 5th of May. His own brother spoke to him on that day, and phone records backed it up. Unfortunately, we don't have information regarding testing done, if any, on that blood that was found in Garnett's apartment. There is a notation that an alternative explanation was offered for its presence, which had to do with IV drug use. Whether or not that was accepted is unclear to us. Without a toxicology report or Garnett's autopsy included in our FOIA results, we can't speak directly to the veracity of the stories that were told about him. Now, obviously, this is quite a bit of information, and anyone who was friends with Garnett at the time of his death would hopefully know if he was in fear for his life, if he was using drugs, and if Andrew suggests if he was hiding that from those he loved, there would still be some people who had knowledge of those activities, and who would know if someone was angry at Garnett, or anyone close to him. To the best of our knowledge, Garnett's case then ended up back with the Detroit Police Department when, based on an interview, Clinton Township Police and Detroit Police decided that, in fact, he might not have been killed in his home. There's a notation in the Clinton Township file saying that interview materials were transferred and the file is marked case closed, so to us that seems pretty certain, but we have placed calls to verify this. They have not been returned, and we will update you if for some reason the case is not with Detroit, but everything in the file indicates to us that the case did ultimately end up back in their jurisdiction. This means that the case moved back and forth 4 times over the investigation of Garnett's disappearance in May and the final notation we found in late September 2007. Based on redactions, we cannot fully explain that reasoning. But ultimately, it seems to come down to statements made by his associates. There is one more lead that we wish we had more information on, an event that could tie the place of Garnett's death once and for all to either Clinton Township or Detroit. On the same Fox News broadcast that Garnett's brothers appeared on, Detroit Police Department made an appeal to the public for information on a particular subject. This came, if you'll recall, about 2 months after Garnett's body was discovered in East Detroit. At that time, Detroit Police appealed to the public with the following information. They said that someone in the Loretto Street area in East Detroit had reported gunshots at or around the time they believed Garnett may have died. There's some thought that this person who made a 911 call may have seen something that could aid in identifying Garnett's killer or killers. We spoke with Andrew about what the family was told and what they heard in the months and years following Garnett's death. Regarding some of those rumors, Andrew told us the following.
At the time, there was a lot of rumors about what went on, about maybe this person was involved some way, this person was involved some way. One of my dad's friends even got accused of being involved.
So who were the people talking about the rumors? Did your dad have a big friend group, or were these family members?
No, these were a little bit of both, because, like, there was the thing about the heroin even back then. But, you know, I had some family members, like even my grandma, she was like, no way, he couldn't have, you know, stuff like that. You know, as the time goes on, a few stories kind of fizzle out, but a few stories also kind of stick. And so that's how we kind of put together what happened, is that some of the rumors just kind of faded away where the truth still stood. You know what I mean? So, like, and, you know, the case is still open. So we really don't know what exactly happened or why it happened.
Did you guys have any speculation as to, like, motive?
Me personally, I heard it was because he left his cell phone somewhere and he went back to get it. That's what I heard. Now, I have no idea what actually happened. I really don't know.
So once this got into the hands of the police, was your family involved closely talking about what may have happened or getting updates?
Yes, actually, my grandpa used to actually have a lunch with the detective once a month about any information that was going on. I'm currently actually trying to find the current detective about the case now, but I really would hope it's not considered a cold case at this point, because I also heard that the guy who did it got murdered himself. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't even know the dude's name. It could just be more rumors.
It was one of Andrew's uncles who was given that information that Garnett's murderer is now deceased. If Andrew can establish contact with Detroit Police Department and find out who was assigned to the case, he can, hopefully, discover whether this lead has been investigated. We've seen this situation before. Generally, people are more willing to talk when an assailant is deceased. Either way, Andrew is determined to reestablish contact. His grandfather was the family's point person on this case, and after his passing, Andrew wants to take on that responsibility. He may live states away, but he's always thinking about his father's case. He knows that it can be solved, with the right piece of information just falling into place. He knows that Garnett would have done the same for him without question, and that's something he thinks about too.
He was definitely the part of the phrase, "only the good die young." That's why I try to be a little bit of an asshole every now and again. But, yeah, I miss him. I realized that most of my life, I wasn't living it for myself. After he passed away, I was living it for him. And that's why I'm not happy anymore. Because I was trying to live it for him when I shouldn't have been living it for me. Because I always wanted to make my dad proud. But I just, you know, I recently realized, you know, if I would have been living my life for me and doing what I wanted to do my whole life, he would have been proud of me either way. So now that's when I'm trying to make a change and try to get better about my life while still remembering him. But it won't be I'm living it for him anymore. It'd be living it for me.
If you have any information regarding the murder of Garnett Lennox in May 2007, please call Crime Stoppers of Michigan at 1-800-773-2587. Tips leading to an arrest are eligible for up to a $2,500 cash reward. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes because it really helps. If you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We use Patreon funds to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We also have occasional video live streams or blogs. If you prefer Apple Premium, we have that feed now as well, so you have an alternative way to contribute. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrill. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. Our monthly donation is currently going to Season of Justice. We've just got word that a third family member who's appeared on our show, Tracy, has had her family awareness grant funded. Season of Justice is funding a billboard for her mother, Janice Becky LaPlante, in Alabama. Starting in December, it will be near the Talladega Speedway.